4 million people signed up to the app in the UK, 8 million globally. Even if I sort of optimize all along the funnel, conversion, engagement, retention, we're not going to get to a revenue growth that's exciting enough that then would enable us to go out and raise a really big Series C to go internationally, which is what is going to be required to help us achieve our mission of mitigating the climate crisis by ending waste one share at a time. We need hundreds of millions of people using Olio.
What's so, that revenue target?
Absolute minimum, I would like to see. Working backwards from that, something's got to change. Tess is my longest successful relationship because I got divorced in the first half of Olio. We took a weekend and we went through the book chapter by chapter and looked at all of the different trade-offs. And at the end of it, we had a blueprint. I do often call her my work wife. I'm not sure she likes it.
It feels most ambitious.
Well, you can't include it because it's sensitive.
This won't release for a while.
Okay, fine. Right now, everything on Olio is...
Welcome.
Thanks, AJ.
Thank you so much for coming. So, what should people know about you?
So, I'm Sasha, and I'm co-founder of an app, a platform, a movement called Olio, on a mission to solve the climate crisis by ending waste one share at a time. And can't believe I'm getting old because I feel young, and I love my friends, my family, and my two cats.
That's a great intro. What does getting old mean to you?
Objectively speaking, it means that I'm closer to 50 than 40. It's a weird thing. I think if you'd asked me in my early 40s, I might have said, oh, I'm getting old. But actually, my energy levels were still the same as they were, you know, my 30s and 20s with regard to appetite for socializing. I think actually, upon reflection, the pandemic happening sort of at the same time in my late, you know, sort of mid to late 40s, maybe accelerated sort of a natural contracting and conservation, perhaps, of energy levels in terms of my appetite for socializing or for even for things like traveling. So by getting old, I think the clock is progressing, but also my preferences are becoming more, they're changing, and it's really interesting to observe.
They're evolving. Yeah, it's so interesting. I always talk to people and they're like, oh, you're so young, I feel so old. And I look at life as like, realistically, we're going to live to 100. And so therefore, 50 is middle-aged.
That's true.
But numbers, so. But anyway, I plan to live to way longer than 100. So
I think objectively speaking, I still feel pretty young. So when I say I'm getting old and I feel young, I mean, I'm incredulous at the fact that I'm actually technically getting older. And even though, yes, my preferences are changing, I'm in no hurry for that to happen, I guess, if that makes sense. Like, I still feel like I've got a whole life ahead of me to live.
How have these changing preferences impacted how you run businesses?
I have actually found, since becoming a parent, and I've got one child who's in 11 and year 7, I have found that syncing up my approach to work with the school calendar is a highly effective way of doing, of running my business. And my co-founder, who's also a parent, I think has leaned into this as well, especially in recent years. So during term, I'm really focused on work. It's a bit like a sprint mentality. So there's sort of 6 week sprints between start of term and half term. And I don't plan like big, huge social occasions if I can avoid it. You know, I'm to bed early, I'm up early, I've got a routine. And it's sort of, and I'm really, work is my number one priority. My mindset is that I need to give that focus and sort of be, I guess, very conscientious about work during that time. But then come the end of term, I'm really comfortable not having my weekly meetings. I'm working fully flexibly or taking a whole week off or 2 weeks or 3 weeks or whatever off and just decompartmentalizing. So I forget the actual question that you asked me. which is how have my working preferences evolved. I'm going to let you follow up.
That was a great answer. So then summer holidays, they're long.
Yeah, so this will be the first year that summer holidays 8 weeks, but my son spends the first 4 weeks with his father and the second four with me. And I'm very much planning to do the same thing those first 4 weeks. Actually, that's not true because I'm taking a week off cycling in the Outer Hebrides, which will be no work and all one-on-one time with my husband wild camping. How does that work? Well, to be honest, I think in the summer holidays, most of the world, or at least parents who are very often actually the decision makers that I'm dealing with in other organizations, they're all on a similar timeline. Mm-hmm. And so it doesn't mean that no work gets done, but certainly things slow down in the summer, especially here in Europe, in a way that I never saw in the US when I worked there. So it is a lighter touch approach to work during the summer holidays, which isn't great if you're trying to sell or close deals or anything like that.
Or fundraise.
But a lot gets done September, October, November. So
that's true. Yeah. August and December feel like the dead months of the year.
Yes.
You've spoken about fundraising elsewhere. Mm. Always be fundraising. That's Tessa's.
ABF is one of our mottos.
ABF. And you've raised $53 million today, which is amazing.
Thank God we saved some of it.
And largely from female investors. Is that right? Because they sort of get it.
More. Certainly our early stage, in our first few rounds, we had a much higher success outcome pitching to female founder or female investors. Our partner at Excel and also at Octopus, and between Excel and Octopus, I think they led our first three rounds, were female. And the value proposition of Olio does skew more female. And that's because women, for whatever reason, are still in charge of the household food budget, the household inventory of books, toys, clothes, and make quite a few decisions around consumption in general in the home. And therefore they're the best ones to be thinking about what could or could not be shared and how they're going about potentially sustainably sourcing things that they need for their own home from their neighbors. It's a value proposition that tends to resonate more with women. And therefore we really did look to pitch to as many women as possible in order to sort of break through the noise. And that was quite helpful. The sad part is that there's just not enough women to pitch to.
Mm. Exactly. There's this disconnect between people invest with things that they understand, right? And the majority of investors are men. So then that then perpetuates down to less female founders getting invested in, etc. But there are obviously groups growing of female founders or female angels investing in only female businesses, which are amazing.
I know, but what you still need, definitely, I think on the angel front, you've seen a lot of women who have the means and who have the resources being really focused on sort of, helping the next generation of female founders. Where there's still a real gap is with regard to lead investors, and because you need funds usually or VCs who can write much bigger checks. And then there's not enough women at the IC level. So there's a big gap still, sadly, but at least I think there's growing awareness.
Yeah. And there are groups popping up. There's a woman called Sophie Winwood who has started a community called WVCE, which is Women in VC.
Okay.
And that's growing like wildfire because women in these environments need community and support because it is, I can only imagine that it's very tough, cutthroat and tough for them. Anyway, aside from fundraising, I would love to touch on what we spoke about briefly before, which is values. And you very clearly stated your values as being caring, resourceful, ambitious, and inclusive.
Yes.
And you mentioned how you use these as a lens with which you look through when recruiting, when managing people's performance, when setting strategy amongst pretty much every area of the business, right?
Yes, absolutely.
But I would love to know practically what does that look like? So let's assume you're talking about recruiting. Mm. How do you think about being caring, resourceful, ambitious, and inclusive when it comes to recruiting? And what does that look like in the process?
So I think it's probably the ex-management and consultant in both Tess and I that loves a good framework and loves embedding a good framework. And so when we've embedded our values, it has been very thorough. In recruiting, it's obviously from, you know, it's on our website, in our recruitment videos that we've done. We talk about what each of those mean in practice. And those are obviously hosted on our website. Any recruiter we work with is briefed on what we mean by these and how to screen for them. So we've got some like pre-screening questions to help with that initial phase. It's in the job description. We clearly articulate what they all mean. In the, not the first fit interview or the second, I think, technical interview, but in the final interview, which is the meaty interview, the one that requires, you know, 6-7 hours potentially of preparation, which where they're preparing back, presenting back actual work they've completed, or everything is, they have to structure everything that they present back through the lens of the different values. And then we also ask them to present to us on an example from other aspects of their life, professionally or personally, a case study from their own life on each of the values to bring it to life for us. So that's, and then of course, when we assess the candidates, we specifically assess them against the values. It really is, those are the four pillars through which almost, you know, most conversations are held. And, you know, on our Slack channels, if you sort of searched for resourceful value or caring value, like you would just see that it comes up all the time. And I think what the powerful thing about it, because we're a very, we're not a cutthroat organization, right? We're a group of people who care passionately about the planet, community, the future. And that does make us a bunch of big softies sometimes. And what having values does is gives everyone a common language by which to sometimes have uncomfortable conversations or to pass to assess things in a maybe a more stark light than you would otherwise if you didn't want to hurt someone's feelings or you wanted to because we can actually tend to be too caring as an organization. But too when caring. we as an organization can tend to be too caring, I think because of the way. Because of the people that we, and by too caring, I mean find it difficult to give difficult feedback or potentially, you know, make a really tough decision. But we can use the language of the values to force difficult conversations. So rather than saying like, actually, I think that that might not be a good ROI, you can probe around, is it ambitious? Is it resourceful? And then you've got a common language that forces tough decisions. Can help enable more difficult conversations for, so we're a really big fan of using our values everywhere and it's super embedded in how we think about everything.
Can you give me an example of having a difficult conversation
yeah.
and that's been aided through the framing of the lens of these values?
So just, I think last week for the first time, we've got a large newsletter subscriber base, over 1.3 million subscribers, great open rate, 40%.
Wow.
And you can sponsor it if you want. Just reach out, media@oleoapp.com. Anyway, we're trying to figure out how to monetize this asset. And whilst I was away on vacation, not checking my emails, sorry, that I did say, however, that just for this one topic only, they could email me in my personal email, which is why I got looped in. But we decided to trial like programmatic ads in the newsletter to see what kind of revenue we could generate. And there are all these considerations around placement and image or copy or text or this or what categories are excluded or not excluded. And my chief of staff, who I love, but he's very thorough, he was trying to, he looped in too many people into too many email threads to try and, and, you know, come up with a consensus-based approach to what form this new advertising experiment should take. And I was able to say, I don't feel like we're being resourceful. We're not living our resourceful value because we have too many people included, given that the stakes are actually relatively low. Everyone else, please be drop off of this. Please drop everyone else off of this. And I will work directly with Emily in marketing to get this over the line. And we will make a decision because there were 8 people looped into multiple emails and it's just not resourceful with people's time. So without saying, okay, you've gone ahead and we've got process bloat, I could just say we're at risk of not being living our resourceful value. I will take this forward directly to make good use of everyone's time. So there's just one example, and that is sort of threaded throughout everything. I could have also equally said, and I'm pretty sure I did, that when there was a bias, a conservative bias, to go towards like text-only ads, I could then use the language of we're not living our ambitious value by taking a risk, because it's very unlikely that the conversion on a text-only ad is going to generate enough revenue to help us, you know, reach our goal to be on a path to profitability. So just that's how we sort of weave the values throughout everyday conversation, help accelerate decision making.
How did the ads go?
Horribly.
Amazing.
Horribly.
How come?
Absolutely horribly. The ads went horribly because I think we worked with a provider who places the ads who we thought was of a greater sort of scale and repute than they are. Actually, I think they're probably just another startup trying their best to place ads. They don't have huge ad inventory. So we've just decided to switch and try a new provider. And so that's what we'll do next. But we didn't lose anything. And no one even noticed there were ads. So it didn't really matter, except for me.
Yeah.
I got like two ads for a doorbell or something. We should be able, with that subscriber base, with that open rate and click-through rate, there's no reason that we're not getting, you know, many thousands of pounds a month. In capturing the eyeballs that are looking at our newsletter, engaging with it anyway. And we have a really limited marketing budget right now. And I need that money so I can put it back in the top of the funnel. We're a network. Even though we've got, I think, really good engagement, retention, et cetera, people do churn. And a shrinking network is counterproductive when you need network effects. So we're just looking for lots of different ways to generate incremental revenue to top up the top of the funnel.
Makes complete sense. Multiple revenue streams, de-risking any single revenue stream.
Yes.
But the majority of revenue stream comes from your B2B side.
Yes. I think we're about 85% revenue from the B2B side. And then the remainder is a subscription version of our app combined with advertising in the app, for which you can subscribe to remove if you don't want to see advertising. And we now put ads in place after you've had a few successful requests. Each incremental request, you know, you need to watch an ad in order to make the request when you're requesting free food.
And how has that impacted the user experience that you've seen through the data?
From our point of view, it's been very successful because for a few reasons. We've also at the same time put in place a hard cap so that no one can have more than 100 successful requests in a month, which you might think sounds like quite a lot, and you're right, it is. We were having this problem whereby 50% of the value that it takes place, and that's millions of meals every single month, was going to 11% of our users who were super requesters, who were on the app all the time and just requesting things first and getting unfair access, quite frankly. So we've capped that upper limit, which has caused quite a few people to put, you know, kick up a fuss. And even if you subscribe, you cannot remove that cap. It's really important. We've actually seen the number of successful requesters increase quite considerably. We've got over 40,000 people who make a request every month and never receive a single thing. And then we have other people who are getting thousands of pounds of value. So flattening the distribution curve is a huge priority for us. But it does ruffle people's feathers because we're talking about perishable food, often only has a few hours, if not minutes, shelf life on it. After that expiry date, if that food has been donated by a business that's paid for us to redistribute it to the community and we don't get it to someone, you know, we're letting food go to waste, quite frankly. Even though it's still safe to eat 1 minute past midnight, it's not legal to distribute after that time. So it's incredibly complex trying to manage the marketplace and balance the need to spread the value fairly and far and wide with the need to minimize waste of any kind and maximize transactional liquidity. So ads have been very helpful also because we now host community webinars on a quarterly basis. Several hundred people sign up to the webinar and we walk them through all of our sort of new strategic decisions that we've taken. And we give our users an opportunity to challenge us, but mostly what it does is just get them on board so they're not complaining behind our back about decisions we made in isolation and they don't understand the rationale behind it. So we've got a lot of people who are on the forum, which is the interactive town hall style place in the app where people can talk to each other. And when someone new joins and says, I don't understand why I've got, I have to see an ad every time I request. Then we got lots of other people who say, well, here's the link to the webinar. Olio loses this much money for every pound that it earns, and it's not going to be profitable until it does this, and ads will help do this. And they're basically making the economic justification on our behalf. So that's a long answer to your question, but ads have actually really exceeded our expectation. And if I had, I have one regret, it's that we didn't do it earlier.
And perfect segue into your community, because you have one of the most impressive community-powered businesses. You've got over 100,000 volunteers in your volunteer program, but you have different types of communities and subgroups and different types of volunteers. Can you break down the sort of almost org chart of your community?
Yes, we are community powered. Such an interesting word, community, and you do see a lot of like community washing. But by community, what I mean is people who feel an affinity towards other people that have are connected through your product or service, whether you're in the room or not, and that affinity sort of has a life and power of its own. And the way we've harnessed that is through our grassroots volunteer program. And we've got multiple different types of volunteers. At one point we had 8, but now we primarily have 2, and we excluding the sort of some hierarchy within those 2. And one is building out the supply side of the marketplace. Those are our food waste heroes. There's 120,000 of those, and they go through a food safety training program and then are registered and allowed to claim collection slots at businesses that have surplus food that can't be discounted, can't be donated to charity, still good to eat, but needs to be collected ASAP or it's going to end up going to waste. And they collect that food, take it straight home, add it to the app and give it, and then just like any other person would add something to the app they want to give away, they manage the requests, and then their neighbors come around and pick up the food that they requested that same evening. So it's the distribution of food that was sourced from businesses, and that's also how we've monetized. And the volunteer gets to keep 10% of that food as a thank you, and that is the supply side. On the demand side, we have ambassadors. We used to call them community heroes instead of food waste heroes, community heroes, but now they're ambassadors. And they're unpaid as well. And they're out there spreading the word, trying to get people to sign up to Olio to create an account and to look within their own homes to see what they could give away, food or otherwise. They claim a marketing kit, which is hyperlocal, and they go out and hand out flyers and do lots of sort of old-fashioned, simple things to spread the word. And those two sort of volunteering pathways are really at the heart and the engine of Olio. We didn't have any paid advertising for the first several years. We grew exclusively through those channels and any sort of just organic media press that we got. And now that we have no marketing budget right now, we really rely on those channels to grow the marketplace.
Wow. That is almost like the dream founder situation. It's there almost in all of your marketing. It's word of mouth.
Yes.
To how many marketing spends.
We do. We have about 70,000 new signups every month, and we ask everyone what, you know, how they signed up, and it's that vast majority, I forget, but 75% word of mouth. Yeah.
I'd love to segue on to you and Tessa, your co-founder. And I know that you guys met 20 years ago at business school, and you were looking to solve a problem in the climate space.
Yep.
And then Tessa stumbled upon this problem when she was moving house, and they told her that she had to throw away her food, and she couldn't, or she had to get rid of her food and she couldn't give it away. And so hence the idea for earlier was born. But you guys did something so mature in how you started your co-founder relationship. Can you talk to that, please?
I think for Tessa and I, the stakes were really high because we're really close friends. Our group of girlfriends is, you know, sort of the core group of girlfriends that we have in our adult life, not that we don't have other friends. And therefore, the risk of screwing that up by not getting it right in business was really weighed on us as we thought about entering into a more formal business relationship. And so to de-risk that, we're both obsessively listened to podcasts and audiobooks. And I think even Founder's Dilemma, I'm not sure how we learned about it, but we must have heard on a podcast that someone had used it to facilitate a co-founder formation. And we took a weekend and we went through the book chapter by chapter and looked at all of the different trade-offs that the book sort of highlights. Do you care more about sort of the size, or, you know, would you rather have a smaller part of a bigger pie, or like more control when a larger part of a smaller pie, and all of those types of orientations that are easy to take for granted that you might assume, you know, or think about someone or assume they think the same way as you. We took time to just clarify what our ingoing preferences were, what success looked like, what we hated doing, what we loved doing. And at the end of it, we had a blueprint, a couple page Word document that just, we both agreed, really formed the foundation of how we were going to work together, how we were going to divide our time, and also, you know, in certain situations, who was going to be able to make different decisions. Tess is the CEO, I'm the COO, and push comes to shove, you know, she gets to make a strategy decision. Now, of course, she wouldn't want to make one without having me fully on board, but I'm the sort of de facto CFO as well, and push comes to shove, I get to decide how and where we allocate budget. And of course, I wouldn't want to do that in a way that caused conflict, but those sort of two, that split actually is quite a fair and even one. She hates the numbers anyway, and I'm too down to earth to be a big visionary. So it does work out quite well. I'm really, really grateful for my relationship with Tessa. And I know that it's probably that, and the fact that we're solving something that's really meaningful and really big, which therefore motivates our community. Those are our two secret sauces.
What a beautiful way to start your co-founder marriage.
I do often call her my work wife. I'm not sure she likes it.
I suppose labels are irrelevant.
She tolerates it, though, as one does with their spouse.
Rewinding back to that weekend, can you speak to any of the way-ups which were contentious or which were more difficult to work through?
I'm so sorry. It was quite a long time ago now. Yeah. It's 10 years ago. I think the only thing that sort of springs to mind is that, there were probably two things that we needed to work through. There are some areas of overlap, things that both interest us. For example, marketing. And Tess is more interested in the sort of brand marketing side, and I'm more interested in the like communications and performance marketing and that side. But we're too small, very much too small when we were, you know, just a couple people for a long time to have any kind of division in marketing. And so working through who was going to sort of lead on marketing, what our approach would be, because obviously how you show up in the world is really important. But you can spend a lot, you need to trust, allocate, and then trust that the other person is speaking on your behalf. And so the marketing has always been one where it's just required extra effort. And I think we've just agreed that we'd rather have be safe than sorry for that. The other thing, we got really specific about roles and responsibilities. So the other thing was on whether or not there should be a small equity premium for Tessa, which we called the idea premium. It's very small, but it's symbolic. And I mean, it's not in any way nearly enough that would ever make me feel disincentivized or not like a 50-50 sort of partner in this journey. But it's enough to make Tessa feel recognized for having that light bulb moment. And you know, that's equity is always such a sensitive thing to discuss. So emotional, because at the end of the day, you're both sweat, blood, and tears are the same, right? So I think we handled that. I'm quite proud of how we handled that sensitive conversation and arrived at a place that we had one conversation. It was fair. It achieved its objective. And I forgot about it more or less till now. if that makes any sense. So that was probably one.
What are you proud of specifically in that conversation? Is it sort of how you showed up or how you structured the conversation or how you communicated in it?
I mean, I think put not necessarily in that conversation specifically, but what Tessa and I have done since the very beginning, and it's been very deliberate, is that we've treated each other, always assumed the best from the other person. And always, like, you have to nurture a relationship. You have to, it's no different than, you know, in your personal life, in your romantic relationship, you have date nights, right? And you celebrate anniversaries and you do things to remind each other that you're grateful for the other person, that you're attracted to them, that you find them special, that you respect them. Obviously, it's not quite the same in a work relationship, but, you know, Tess is my longest successful relationship, actually, now that I think about it. I got divorced during the middle of, you know, in the first half of Oleo. And so what I'm trying to say is what I'm most proud of is how conscientious and deliberately we have tended to our relationship to address problems early on so that nothing festers, resentment doesn't fester, and that each is allowed to feel like they can blossom in a healthy way without sort of, I don't know, I have this picture of two plants, and maybe because you've got some plants here, AJ. But like we both need to be able to grow with and share, but we share the same soil. And it's really about, you know, cutting off, gently trimming dead leaves whilst making sure that no one is overshadowing the other. And that approach, I think, isn't happenstance. It's deliberate, and we both are very deliberate about it.
Can we go into detail, given that you two are two ex-consultants and love a framework? Do you have a framework around how you co-grow in the healthiest and most harmonious way?
It has changed over time, but the most important thing has been to carve out one-on-one time. And without being too prescriptive, it was probably a half a day every week, and we've been remote since day one. So for 9 years, Tessa lives a couple hours away in Wiltshire, but it was probably a half a day every week at least that we spent one-on-one together to make sure, not always necessarily an intense conversation, just deliberately making space, for things that are hard to do over a video call or when you're in a 30-minute meeting. And then it moved to, full day a month, and I would go down to her house and spend time there. And then it moved to a day, a quarter, and that's about where we are now, where it's just the two of us, because so much can change. And even when you've been working together for as long as we have, and tension, I think, arises when you both start making assumptions upon assumptions. And before you know it, you've ended up quite a few degrees apart. And so that recalibration to make sure that you're both processing new information in the same way. Now it's so second nature because we know each other so well. But in the beginning, it was really easy to process information in different ways, arrive at different conclusions, and then make an assumption that was totally opposite to how someone else had processed the information. So I think that because we're so sensitive to the fact that that can happen, we have this process of like really frequent recalibration. So my first meeting every Monday is a one-on-one with her. And the first 20 minutes are usually spent talking about what nonsense we got up to at the weekend or our husbands got up to, our kids got up to. It's also really important that we don't just talk business all the time. The other thing that we do is we recognize the roles that our families play in often being subservient in priority to Oleo. Because anyone who's founded a business knows that it can be completely all-consuming. And so at least twice a year we go away with our families, and one of those we actually expense, and we spend a couple of days with them and celebrating the fact that they, without them, we wouldn't have Oleo either, and that their commitment, you know, their patience and support makes it possible for us to show up at work. And we genuinely take time to thank our kids and our partners for Oleo on behalf of Oleo. And then the other, we do always take an annual trip together, whether it's skiing or this year we're going to Turkey for a week and just have fun and be, you know, friends, which is how we started out 20 years ago.
So you have your Monday morning catch-up call.
Oh, yeah. We've got Monday and we've got Thursday. I mean, we also WhatsApp each other about 20 times a day.
Of course.
And leave the voice notes and all of that.
Yeah. You then got your now once a quarter in-person day, just the two of you. And you're on two joint family holidays.
Yeah.
And then one extra just you two holiday.
Actually, we did go on a you two. We went on our first us two holiday last year. We went on a retreat, which was just us for a long weekend. As much as our families love Olio, they don't necessarily want us to go away on holiday, just the two of us. So that was a bit of a luxury. So we can't quite get away on going away on holiday, just the two of us, without partners and children in tow. No.
Gotcha.
That's crossing a line.
Okay. Well, you only realize that there's a line after you've experimented what you can.
I think Tessa and I's friendship and strong working relationship is due to very deliberately recalibrating frequently to make sure that we are in alignment, and just a principle that, you know, it's not okay for us to let any conflict fester. It's more important to no one individual thing that we might be in conflict about can take priority over the greater union that is us, which includes Olio, but also our friendship group, and our families. And also it's a reinforcing thing, because the more we work well together and the more we're able to sort of stand down on maybe potentially short-term irritations or whatnot that are natural for anyone and like take a longer term perspective, then the stronger our relationship becomes. And then and our team members absolutely love our relationship, right? They love that we're very, very different people, but they never feel like they're getting conflicting leadership. Mm. And so the benefits of working together in the way that we do far outweigh any of the short-term gains that might come from not being aligned.
Does your recalibration and alignment follow any sort of structure?
No.
So when you go to Tessa's house, it's a case of, cool, we have four things that we aren't completely aligned on, which have shown up in meeting A, B, C, and D.
No, it's not like that at all, actually. When I say we need to be aligned, I mean that there is this thing, which is a hypothetical vision. There's a vision for Olio, which is a series of hypotheses based on current information and best guess, right, about future events. This is a living, breathing thing. And hypotheses are always being evolving. And what we have to be aligned on is our hypotheses, because that forms what our vision is. Where's our growth going to come from? How are we going to get, reach our targets? You know, what everything sort of ladders up. I cannot tell you how many different faces our vision has taken over the years, even though, of course, our mission stays the same. And what we need to align on is a vision that excites us both, that both we both can see a path to, and a feasible path to, with, and you know, that's, and that tests all of the assumptions that go into the hypotheses that make that up. And we will have gathered different information, spoken to different people, gotten different views on the market, have a different Tessa might be really excited about doing something, and I'm feeling actually that's unlikely to result in sort of commercial outcome in the time in which we need. But, you know, like it could be as simple as speaking to someone at a conference and then getting like really positive buy-in signals. And then meanwhile, I might be actually speaking to the decision maker and doing the pitch and finding out that this company that we're selling into is about to deprioritize this for the foreseeable future and there's no opportunity there. And both of those are information that feed into the commercial forecast. So it's this iterative process. What I'm trying to say, I'm not saying it very elegantly, is the misalignment isn't like there's like things, it's just confirming that we have the same vision.
Well, yeah, and the same and, information that contributes to how you've crafted this vision.
Yes, and a lot of times, it's not like I'll show up. A lot of times by the time we're getting ready on a quarterly basis to recalibrate our visions, we also need to get each other excited again, because sometimes you've got bad quarters. You've got bad information, right? And, you know, if you're not feeling like everything is possible, that you're going to have the impact that you that motivates you, that like we cheer each other up. There's definitely often a process of getting pumping each other up again, getting each other really excited, feeling, you know, can do and ambitious about the future. So that's definitely plays a part in it. So aligning on our vision, pumping each other up again, making difficult decisions. Like I can remember last year we needed to make a decision, quite unfortunately, to, you know, restructure and let go of nearly a third of the team. That was called the Windsor Plan, because our day for doing that was spent at a hotel together. We actually shared a room, shared a bed in Windsor. And
married couple.
Only because we're resourceful, which is one of our values. You know, we got under the covers, pulled out our laptops and did the math and had to, like, you know, think through headcount by headcount, given what it is we need to achieve and what our runway was, you know, what difficult decisions did we need to make with regard to a restructure. So I guess what I'm saying is we don't have a formal agenda, and it's not to sort of usually to align on sort of there's not misaligned things we need to work through. Mm-hmm. It's about coming together and making sure that we're aligned on everything that makes up our vision. Sorry, just to be clear, over the last 9 years, you know, we've had 100 days one-on-one when we've needed to spend time together working things through. The agenda varies dramatically from one to the next, depending on what's most pressing at that time. Of course, some of them are vision recalibration exercises. Sometimes they're, you know, horribly boring and we need to go through line item by line item, you know, expenses or something equally tedious. We've also had many days where we've stood on street corners and handed out flyers, harassed passerbys, trying to get them to, like, I don't know, tell us what they thought about our food sharing app. So I think there's no formula, right? And I think actually trying to be too prescriptive about how and what you discuss with your co-founder during these dedicated times together could be counterproductive.
Mm. Sounds like they're super nuanced and you have to take what's thrown at you, right?
Yeah, just like life.
Just like life. Can you share an example of the last vision iteration? I'd love to know, like, what that actually looks like when it comes down to, oh, cool, we're going to tweak this word, or we're going to tweak how we phrase it, or does it look like that?
So we're currently, Olio's currently at a scale that's not insignificant, but because we're a complex multi-sided marketplace, often in marketplaces you hear about the sort of the chicken and the egg. And we actually, I think, have gotten through that for the most part, in that we now have 4 million people signed up to the app in the UK, 8 million globally. You know, we have 20 million user sessions a month. But if I look at my current use cases and how I can monetize those current use cases, free food, free non-food, buying and selling non-food, borrowing and lending non-food, whatever, my current use cases, even if I sort of optimize all along the funnel, conversion, engagement, retention, best case scenario, in the UK only, with my current use cases, even if I sort of get to my, you know, reduce my churn from my premium supporter package, et cetera, we're not going to get to a revenue growth or revenue number that's exciting enough. Right? We can get to profitability, but we're not going to get to really exciting numbers that then would enable us to go out and raise a really big Series C to go internationally, which is what is going to be required to help us achieve our mission of mitigating the climate crisis by ending waste one share at a time. We need hundreds of millions of people using Olio.
What is that revenue target that would be exciting enough to raise your Series C?
Well, the thing is that the it keeps shifting, right? But I would say absolute minimum I would like to see sort of 10 million or at least on path to 10 million ARR. Working backwards from that, something's got to change, right? Given our current use cases. So we've got this asset, many millions of people. So either we've got two parts of the business. I got the B2B part. There's only so much we can do to accelerate B2B sales a little bit, although we can bring new services and solutions to market and there's account growth and all kinds of things, but that's one set of scenarios. And then looking at the C2C side, basically what I need to do is I need to 5 to 10x the amount of activity that's happening in the app, right? On that side. If I could do that, hell yeah. We are like start to get really exciting. Okay, but how am I going to do that if I don't want to spend a bunch of money on marketing at the top of the funnel? So what we've
realized... 5 to 10x the activity in the app from your existing users or 5 to 10x?
The engagement. The engagement. And that's really also we've realized how much money there is to be made from advertising. So right now what I'm trying to say is that we've got quite a number of people who come in and do certain things in the app and they do it pretty well. What I need to do is... And what our strategy is to make Olio more useful to more people more of the time so that people spend more of their time in the app, which will help to drive advertising revenue and also conversion to supporter. And we've got this asset. It's a bit like Amazon. If you were Amazon and you sold books and then you added in electronics, that's about where we are. And we're looking at our captive user base and we're realizing that we need to add in video. We need to add in Audible. We need to add in streaming. We need to...
So you're capped to what?
We've got a captive audience. You know, hundreds of thousands of people coming into the app all the time, using it to give away and get, to buy and to sell, to lend and to borrow, food and non-food. And we're taking up a certain portion of their time. There's so much utility that we're leaving on the table for this audience around what are the themes that make up our brand. Hyperlocal, like in real life, hyperlocal, sustainability, living a more sustainable life cycle, and frankly, money saving. Significant portion of our users are either on a budget or, just much more conscious about their cost base. And so we're introducing new use cases and we're layering on more and more utility for our existing audience rather than trying to really grow the number of users. So last week we launched events. It's actually a soft launch and it's coming this weekend. So you can find and list, you know, it's like Eventbrite, but local for everything. Whether it's, you know, your kombucha making class to, you know, your book club to whatnot, all is the event notice board. And there's a whole series. It just leverages the same underlying functionality that we have for the other sections, but provides additional utility around hyperlocal, sustainable, money saving. So we've got a deals section coming soon with all kinds of offers. Can't go into too much detail on that. We've got a volunteering section coming soon because our volunteering is all of our voluntary management is taking place out of the app, which doesn't make any sense, on a separate, totally separate volunteer hub, which the average everyday person doesn't even know about. So there's a lot of consolidation and extension, use case extension to make Olio more useful to more people more of the time. And then I can see a path that really helps to contribute to the revenue that we need and the stickiness as well that we need to help us think about sort of our next stage of growth.
In terms of extensions of use cases, yes. What feels most ambitious?
Well, you can't include it because it's sensitive.
This won't release for a while.
Okay, fine. All right. Oh gosh, it's complicated to explain. Right now, everything on Olio is neighbor to neighbor. It's really about connecting people in real life, even if the things that they're giving away or getting may have been donated by a business, it's still a neighbor-to-neighbor interaction. And one thing that we haven't done deliberately to date is develop a discounting proposition to send people into stores. But that is certainly something that now that we have a captive audience of users who hate waste, love a bargain, it makes sense to think about what we can get those users to do in terms of driving them into stores, footfall into stores, to buy food at sale at a discount. So what I'm talking about is what feels most ambitious is moving up the food waste recovery hierarchy, which basically, if you're a business and you're thinking about your surplus food that's going to waste, you are going to try and recover the economic value for that through discounting in-store or through a third-party platform. Then you're going to donate what you can to charity or to vulnerable populations, and we work very closely with lots of charities. And then lastly, and this is a new step in the hierarchy that we've created and is really the innovation that we've done, is donating food to the general community regardless of need. So we're the last stop for edible surplus food after they've tried discounting, they've tried donating to charity, and there's still 2.4 billion meals left over in the UK every year. But what we want to do next, and the next really ambitious thing we're doing, is just to move right up the hierarchy. So the next step up the hierarchy is developing our own charity first, community second proposition, which we will, of course, do in tandem with existing charities. But basically taking our, frankly, best-in-class volunteer management program and extending it to manage charities' volunteers. So that we can have this, because the big gap comes when charities just are less reliable, more difficult to manage. They're not approached with the same, I don't want to call it ruthlessness, but the same like diligence in the way that we approach managing volunteers through our platform. So taking that we do really well, which is scalable, automated management of volunteer network, extending that into charity. So more food can get to charity, but we get the benefit of all of that volume coming through our platform. And then going one step up even further, which is helping businesses to discount their food more effectively and have higher sell-through rates of that discounted food. And we have to do all of these in tandem so that we're basically playing along the entire length of the food waste recovery hierarchy. So that's the most exciting because we're going to go, it took a long time to earn the trust of the charities in order for them to say, actually, you might be better at managing volunteers than we are. We want to do this with you in a way it doesn't feel like it's cannibalizing or threatening the food that's going to charities. We can see how this will help get more food to charities. And also it means going up into the discounting proposition. We will go head to head with a number of existing incumbents. So I'm excited, but also quite nervous. But I know that because we've already proven that we can manage volunteers at scale and we've got this millions of people on the app, that I think we can do both quite successfully.
Very exciting. That is ambitious.
It's ambitious, yes. So reading between the lines, we're going head to head with Too Good To Go, which you can't include yet until we actually do it.
Okay. We'll time this perfectly for whenever you launch it. I want to very quickly touch on being a founder-led brand and how that has evolved into being a founder-led company, in your words.
Okay.
What do those two things mean?
I think Tessa and I realized quite early on that the very limited budget and a lot of energy, that the best way to, one of the good way, best ways to spend our time was just out there talking about Olio, spreading the word about Olio. We're lucky in that the problem we're solving is quite an emotional one. People are really buy into it quite quickly, maybe in a way they wouldn't with, I don't know, health tech or fintech or something that's less sort of existential in nature. Like we're trying to, you know, solve the climate crisis and feed people. So we've been out there storytelling since day one. Anyone who would ask us, we would show up, whether it's a meetup with like six people or, you know, a lunch and learn at some corporate. I didn't quite realize in the beginning that that would actually mean that we ended up having really strong founder identities and becoming quite visible as founders, speaking on everything from being a female founder to the entrepreneurial journey to sustainability and climate tech and fundraising. And it's self-perpetuating in that the more we were out there, the more people knew we were out there and the more they'd ask us to be out there. And now for the last several years, if I'm honest, you know, I spend a not insignificant portion of my time, probably 20 to 25% every week speaking, doing keynotes, speaking on panels, you know, but doing fireside chats, but basically being able to be myself as part of my job, and reach really large audiences in a credible and authentic way. And that, I guess, means that we are perceived very much as a founder-led brand. Tessa specifically has leaned into this through her writing on Medium and with Sifted. I'm too impatient to do that. The other thing I would say that I've learned is that, and that I have personally leaned into, is trying to be honest with whenever I'm speaking about the, how the personal challenges in one life can be equally, if not more, sometimes dominant than the entrepreneurial challenges of trying to grow and scale a company, and just trying to give a voice to all of those traumas, quite frankly, that we individually experience, not all at the same time, but don't necessarily feel comfortable being public about, whether for me, in my case, it was divorce and the family court proceedings and how heartbreaking that was. And for others, it might be death or illness or health or, you know, all financial problems, all different kinds of stresses. And so I think that my vulnerability in that area has, it's been easy for me because it means I don't have to lie or not be myself, but people have been quite receptive to it. And therefore, when I'm speaking, hopefully I'm resonating with audiences and then I get asked back. And so I guess the founder-led brand has been quite accidental rather than by design. And now it sort of runs itself. And I get to show up, just be truthful, and it's part of my job.
Wow. I love that approach. And I think that ultimately builds trust, which is the cornerstone of any successful community and any company that is rooted in that, and neighborhoods and your people around you. So
twice a year, of course, we do quite thorough employee surveys. And the word transparency as a attribute that's appreciated by the team comes through all the time, loud and clear. We're so transparent about the highs and lows, our highs and lows as the leaders and founders. Of course, we're always trying like make sure that everyone has transparent, and you know that we're transparent about how Olio is performing and what's keeping up at night and everything. Of course, it's a fine line. You would need people to not be so scared they leave and go get a different job. But I think transparency is really important. And actually, it's something that I think you get such positive feedback on when you do take that risk, that it's like a muscle. And the more you practice transparency and get the positive feedback, then the easier it is to practice transparency. But also then the more effective you are at being transparent, and the more people appreciate it, and it just keeps building upon itself, which is also, I guess, another word for trust.
What are the boundaries of your transparency within the business? As you said, you don't want to share things that are going to freak people out. At the same time, it's one of those attributes people love. Where's the line?
I think that a really important boundary is to sequence information in such a way that no one is caught by surprise. And what that means is sometimes you don't tell people things because you can't tell them yet until you've told someone else. And information needs to be sequenced in a way very respectful, especially if it's difficult or challenging information, like someone losing their role, or asking someone to take a demotion, or you know, something that maybe isn't going to be well received. No one should ever find out about that accidentally or through not by design. With regard to other boundaries,
what about runway?
Oh no, we down to the penny. We're clear. We're very transparent about our financial position, because in the absence of information, people will make up their own views, and often, you know, it's really easy for rumors to circulate. So we have our base case, we have our worst case, we have our target case, and we they're all plotted on a line, and we for multiple metrics, and we plot our actual performance against those, so people can see exactly how we're doing. And for each scenario, everyone knows what the runway end is. And also in certain scenarios, what in interim steps would need to be taken in order to extend runway. I mean, our North Star metric this year is burn per listing. So a listing is, you know, supply that comes onto the app. We've got over 1 million listings a month. Each listing has, you know, often 10 or more items. Yeah. So how much money do we lose for everything that comes on the app is our North Star listing, or is our North Star metric. So we have to be very transparent about financials in order for the whole company to orient itself around that.
Makes complete sense. Coming near the end, and I'd love to move away from business chat and more about you as an individual, which will segue in with how did you manage this divorce while building the company, which demands so much of your time and energy and love, and you're going through this horrific personal life experience?
To be honest, I do, if I think about what everything in my life that I've achieved, having the courage to admit that I failed in my marriage, and I do take joint responsibility for that because there were a lot of red flags, was probably the hardest. It is probably the most, one of the things I'm most proud of having done. And probably the reason I'm most proud of it is because it was so challenging for me. It was so challenging. I was absolutely devastated. And, you know, coming as a child of divorced parents who, you know, really didn't speak to each other until I was much older, you know, an adult, and I suffered from their conflict. I was really hated the idea of putting my child through that, putting through something similar. But and anyone who's ever ended a long-term relationship or taken any difficult decision knows that sometimes the decision like almost becomes not your own. Like you become compulsed to follow through on something because you have no other choice because the status quo can't be sustained. What happened was, is I was very ashamed. I felt very isolated. Only two people knew, even amongst my family or my friends, for multiple years whilst I was making this decision, whilst I suffered a series of setbacks and betrayals. I could not confide in anyone. I was too embarrassed. I felt too trapped, and I didn't want to tell people if I wasn't ready to follow through on the consequences of people actually knowing the reality of my marriage. So there was a lot of secrecy, shame, and the way I approached it at the time, which was very unhealthy, was just I didn't disclose it to anyone, which meant most of the time, a significant part of my CPU, my mental processing power, was spent not focused on work. And I felt so guilty about that. I felt so guilty. I was convinced that everyone knew and that I wasn't showing up in the world. And so I overcompensated and I worked extra hard. So I was really, which helped to distract me and prevent me from making a difficult decision. So I was in this sort of just state of trauma, quite frankly. And it wasn't until I really made the decision finally to leave and that I was ready to sort of tell the world the truth, really, about about my marriage and why it was coming to an end. That, and then of course I shared with my team as well, and everyone said, "Oh, I had no idea. We still understand why you're working all the time. Like you're just a machine." And it was a real sort of real lesson that I had put myself through a lot of unnecessary criticism and really taxed myself more than I needed to. And I really did make a decision at that point in time, which is probably why I'm so truthful about it now, is that it was the hardest part about it was carrying around that shame and carrying around that secrecy. And as soon as I opened up and told people and received all that love and support, I was like, I'm never doing that again. Like, this is not a burden that needs to be borne by me, by myself alone. And of course I can't regret anything in life. That's a waste of time. But I'm really glad that I learned how important it is to let yourself be seen. And actually, it's really hard to bring your best self to work. You can fake it. And I did, obviously, but I didn't enjoy it. Didn't enjoy it in the way I did once I started just being truthful with everyone. So it was a really important lesson. And now I tell everyone everything.
Well, thank you so much for sharing this. I felt your pain listening to that. And the phrase that came to me while listening to you was that shame grows in the dark.
Yeah, so true.
The more we hold something in, the bigger the shame and the guilt grows. Did you tell Tessa? Was she one of the two?
Tessa people? Was one of the two people. I actually had a different business prior to Olio, and the two people I told were my two co-founders, because that first business was still going on in the first few years, a lot on the sides, and I had a professional obligation to make sure they knew what was going on, why I was acting a bit crazy sometimes.
Yeah. And so then fast forward, now have a beautiful new marriage, and
I do
who. I had the privilege of chatting to you before our competition. What do you think he said about you and your relationship?
Well, we got married last year. We've been together for 7 years. He's just like lightness, you know. He's just one of the most positive, grounded, wise people I've ever met. And so what would he have said? I hope he recognizes that he's the anchor to my sort of, I can be a bit more turbulent in my approach to life, a bit more chaotic, and he's like steadfast, and he really is my sort of my anchor, and not in a boring way, like tying me down, just keeping me from drifting off in the middle of nowhere. I don't know. What did he say? Are you going to tell me?
I'm going to show you.
Oh God, this is interesting. Oh, it's a great frame shot there, AJ.
Thanks. How is Sasha amazing in your eyes?
That's a multifaceted one. We are chalk and cheese as far as where we come from. But we are massively lifestyle aligned. So she's just like a whirlwind, Sasha, to me. There's that she can schedule a shower into her day, right? Which is and it has a time. There's like a 4 minute shower break for somebody so small. She can make a hell of a racket. That's another thing that I think is amazing about her. You never don't know she's in a room.
Yeah. If someone said Sasha is the culmination of these three values, what do you think they are?
Love.
Aww.
Professionalism. No, love, efficiency, I think is a better one. And fun.
Oh,
I love that. Those are great three. Mm. Can we touch on each of them? Like, how does...
Do you want me to see this whole thing now?
Feel loved?
Okay.
As well.
No.
She's quite open with that, you know. She's not you don't have to sort of prod too much to kind of get it out of her, you know. She makes sure, you know, we both say to each other about sort of gratitude and being grateful every day and that kind of stuff, and so it's never I think it comes completely natural to both of us. So it's never like how does she show it? It's just all the time, you know. I mean, she would say the same about, so I make the coffee every morning, for example, right? But I literally put the coffee down next to her when she's like just waking up. And that's like the biggest thing I can do all day, right?
Yeah.
What was the other one? Efficiency. How does she, well, I mean, come on. You know Sasha. How well do you know Sasha, right? What I love about Sasha is she gets louder and she gets more efficient, right? Which is fantastic. And fun, come on. I mean, like, you know, that's also completely apparent at all times, isn't it? She has this amazing ability to switch between like the professionalism / efficiency part into this kind of fun person, and all of a sudden you're dealing with a, you know, a complete wild child rather than somebody that's just, you know, broken to deal with something.
What's been a like defining memory in your relationship? You tell me a story.
Where do you start? I mean, obviously the one that we tell regularly is the first time we met.
This is so funny.
Which was in the King's Head in Crouch End. We'd been speaking to each other for about a week on text, and we were getting along so well. We were worried that there wouldn't be a spark when we met, so we made a decision to kiss each other before we said a word to each other. So the first thing we did when we met each other face to face was kiss each other. There wasn't even a hello.
Yeah.
Wow.
That was my first date in like 13 years. And I like
the next level.
This is my first right swipe.
That was your first right swipe.
Yeah. I was on Tinder for 45 minutes.
Wow.
I met him a week after. I joined Tinder on a Monday. We met on a Saturday. That was it.
You've cracked the code.
He was on Tinder for like 5 years, very, off and on.
Okay. So, yeah. Okay. How was your first kiss?
It was great. I was like, I just need to go sit somewhere on my own for a few minutes. Don't take it personally, because I was like going to hyperventilate. I was so like, just flustered. Because I've been in a relationship for a very long time, 13 years at that point. And if you haven't had the butterflies in a while and then you get them after 13 years, you definitely get knocked sideways.
And what an amazing man to knock you sideways.
I feel I've got butterflies now. I'm like, oh, he looks so hot in his suit. I never see him in a suit. Isn't that funny? I said, I'm like, he's like the anchor, and I'm like, keeps me from sort of floating away. And he could describe me as a whirlwind.
There you go.
Yeah.
What do you think you are to him?
I think in some ways, myself and Nolan are a vessel for which he gets to. He had all this love that was going around a bit spare. And he was pretty much he was on his own, he didn't want his own children, and he kept meeting people, and then they'd say they didn't want children, and then they did want children. And basically, whilst all of his friends were settling down and having kids, he was more or less unattached, and he had all this goodwill and love, and he's found a vessel in which to channel it to us. And we're so grateful for it, a little bit because I've been coming from a love desert, right? So thirsty and grateful for this love. And also just because, no child can have too much love. So for Nolan, he's got a whole nother parent. And so I think that matching, it was almost, I've got my marketplace analogy, my supply demand. We were really in need of a lot of love and caretaking. And he just had so much to give. So that was the immediate match. I think Matt quite likes... He's a little bit in the passenger seat, and he lets me carry on and drive things and plan trips, plan holidays and make social plans, whatever, right? And he gets to be like the bemused person in the passenger seat for this ride that is our shared existence. But at the same time, I think he knows that I think he feels my respect for him, because I haven't been able to go on this personal journey that I've gone on. He's been my lighthouse, or whatever the analogy is, that's enabled me to go from, quite frankly, like a broken person to a whole person with cracks that have healed. What he gets from it is a sense of being respected and valued for that. Because it was a lot of his wisdom and coaching and patience, but really his wisdom that helped me make that. And so that means that he feels respected, I think, and valued.
Well, I can say that you're much like those, that practice with those Japanese pots, where they break the pots.
Yes.
Paint them back together with the gold leaf.
And then they're more valued.
And then they're more beautiful, and the cracks become part of the artwork.
Yes.
I would say that you are larger than life, and you infect everyone with like such an amazing energy.
Oh,
and
good.
And I am so happy that you and Matt found each other, and I'm so happy that you and Tessa have such an incredible co-founder relationship. And
I'm so happy to have met you and be part of the whole Founders Network as well. Like, it's been...
You were involved with Founders before I was there.
But yeah, a little bit. Okay. For me, you sort of joined not that long after I joined, in my head mentally, but who knows?
Thank you so much for coming and sharing everything so vulnerably.
My pleasure. I know your channel is going to be a smashing hit. So hit like, subscribe, and share with a friend.
So happy you did it. So happy.